our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends, to the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare answer, no, I don't think so. Last I looked, even though they're trying to claim they are. Welcome back to our program. It's the end of the week, last day of the week here, so it is time, the first hour of our program, for our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, bernie.house.gov, G-O-V. And Congressman Bernie Sanders, first elected to the House of Representatives in 1991 as the first independent congressman in over 40 years. He's since been reelected seven times, longest-serving independent in the entire history of the House of Representatives. I like to think of him as America's congressman, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Hey, Bernie, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And I should add, if when folks have questions, comments, thoughts, arguments, suggestions, whatever, our number 1-866-889-8894, toll-free number. And if you want to drop into the chat room and participate, the number, or the website, rather, is tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. We have all the conceivable misspellings that we could come up with anyway. And just click live chat, and it'll drop you into that. Bernie, the news this last week, once again, occupied by, yesterday, actually, I opened the program by pointing out that in the previous 24 hours, according to the United Nations best estimates, around 38,000 children and around 54,000 adults had died of starvation in the previous 24 hours. One of those 54,000 people, of course, was Terri Schiavo, and that's the only one that we heard about.
Right.
And you know, and that's kind of a micro to the macro. There's a big issue.
You got it, and you're exactly right, and that's a very good example of what the media is covering and what it's not covering. I was in my office last Friday in Washington, and we had CNN on, and you know what? All CNN covered. All. There was nothing else. There was no other news other than Terri Schiavo.
Yeah.
And before Terri Schiavo, there was, I'm sure there's some people very upset at CNN because they can't fully cover the Michael Jackson case.
Yeah.
And we got to worry about Scott Peterson, and you remember Robert Blake was found innocent. And you sit and you think and you say, given, you know, whether it's tens of thousands of people every day who are starving, whether it's the collapse of our healthcare system, whether it is the shrinking of the middle class in America, all of the environmental problems we have, all of the serious problems, what genius has decided that the only thing the American people are allowed to concentrate on is one particular tragedy in one family, or the particular problems of a variety of celebrities? Who decides these things? Why? What's the purpose of it? And let me be a little bit cynical here and tell you that these things, I think, don't happen by accident, that increasingly much of what the media does is designed to deflect attention away from the reality of our lives and deflect attention away from how we can understand about how we can resolve some of these problems, and in the process have to take on the powers that be and the money that's out there. And they don't want us to talk about those things. They want us to talk about Terri Schiavo and Michael Jackson and Scott Peterson rather than how we can have a national health care program that guarantees health care to all people. How do we do that?
Yeah.
What are the best health care systems in the world? What can we learn? Why is it that we're the only country in the industrialized world not to have a national health care system? Why do we spend twice as much per capita on health care as any other country on earth? Why do we pay the highest prices, drug prices, in the world for prescription drugs? Gee, maybe if we talked about those issues with one-tenth the type of courage that Terri Schiavo got, maybe we can make some changes in this country. But if we did that, oh my word, the insurance companies might not be too happy about it. The pharmaceutical industry might not be happy about it. Big money interest might not be too happy about it. So let's not talk about it. Let's entertain the American people. Let's give them the next celebrity crisis tomorrow, and on it goes.
Well, and this is the deal with the devil that so many media companies have made basically since the Reagan era, and with the progressive deregulation of the media, is to say that news is no longer a public service. It's no longer something that, you know, where there's a barrier, an absolute wall between the news department and the marketing department, or the bean counters, the revenue. We don't care if news makes money or not. It's our public service. That used to be, I mean, for a long, long time, that was the way news was perceived by the media. And now it's infotainment. Now it's, you know, what is going to get us the best ratings? How can our network beat their network? Unfortunately, it seems that whether it's good for us or not, as a, you know, good for democracy or not, it seems that, you know, a lot of Americans and would rather learn about Terry Schiavo than would want to, you know, investigate the vagaries of the healthcare system in Sweden,
you know what?
Versus Canada.
You may be right.
I mean, look at the number of people who watch soap operas. I mean, I really think that you know, unfortunately. That there's a, you know, P.T. Barnum was right, and they're you know.
I'm not so sure.
Okay.
I am not so sure. I think, for example, if you had programming which highlighted, I mean, you know how many people die in this country every day because they can't afford the high cost of prescription drugs, or how many people are suffering and end up in the hospital because they delay going to the doctor because they didn't have any health insurance or died? Because I remember doing a town meeting in the northern part of Vermont. And we did it with a physician up there, and the guy got up, the physician got up, and he read an obituary, and he said, you know, the obituary here in the paper says that Mr. so forth and so on died of a heart illness. He didn't die of a heart illness. He died because he didn't have health insurance, and by the time he came into my office, it was too late.
Yeah.
Do you know how many thousands of cases of that exist all over America?
The best stats I've seen are 18,000 people a year in the United States die because of lack of health insurance.
I would suspect it's even higher than that. I mean, it's hard to come up with an estimate, but... The issue here, you want to go to do good TV? Go talk to families who have lost the breadwinner in the house because they didn't have any health insurance. Talk to the kids. That could be good television as well.
Yeah.
And I think people would watch it. But the result of that, when people would see that, and they would say, and it's not only having no health insurance. There are people who do not go to the doctor today because their deductibles are too high. There are people who are staying in careers and in jobs that they don't want to stay in because they have health insurance on that job and can't get it elsewhere. If television were to focus on those issues in creative and intelligent ways, people would say, yeah, that makes sense. That's interesting. That's important. I'm going to watch that. I'm going to debate that. And I'm going to try to find out how we can change that situation.
Yeah. But there's this deal with the devil that's happened. And I remember years ago when I was working in the advertising industry, when I was CEO of an ad agency. And Chrysler, as I recall, is one of the big three automakers, I'm pretty sure it was Chrysler, had decided not to advertise in Esquire magazine, in a particular Esquire magazine issue, because there was an article in that issue which had nothing to do with cars whatsoever. It had to do with homosexuality, and it did not portray homosexuality in a negative light. It was... It wasn't advocacy or anything like that, but it was just an article about, you know, how many gay men are there in America and what kind of impact are they having on our society, and it was just this kind of very interesting investigative reporting in Esquire. Chrysler decided to pull their ad, not with a lot of publicity. In fact, they didn't want any publicity.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to make a statement. And when it was discovered that they had pulled their ad, somebody at Esquire had leaked it. Then, and I was getting advertising age, and this was bombshell news in the advertising industry that, you know, car makers were making advertising decisions based on editorial content. It had never happened before. This was, I think, maybe 20 years ago, and 15 or 20 years ago in any case. And that has, you know, I remember 15, well, not even 15 years ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago when ADM, Archer's Daniel Midland, was indicted for price fixing. Remember that? A big scandal
with
them and
sure.
Cargill and all these companies.
Right.
And all of a sudden, ADM is sponsoring public radio.
Right.
And maybe it's just a coincidence, but since they started sponsoring public radio, I have not heard any stories about price fixing among the big agricultural combines.
Right.
It's just gone away, but who knows?
No, I think what you're absolutely right is this is the barrier that we have to real news in America. Number one, most of major media is now owned by large corporate conglomerates who have their own special interest, owned by very wealthy people who have their own set of priorities. And then you got the people who advertise, who also exert, as you're indicating, enormous influence on the content, either directly or indirectly. They don't have to be blackmailing it. They make it very clear. But in terms of direct conflicts of interest, just give you one example, which is just so apparent that it's not debatable. General Electric owns NBC. Now, right. You just think of General Electric as one of the largest corporations in the world with money in all kinds of industries. They are deeply involved in trade because the CEO of their company has indicated that the future of General Electric is in China.
Well, in fact, in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal last week, while you were out of the country, the front page story was about how Jack Welch started the whole outsourcing movement in the United States
right.
by accident with a trip to India where he went to sell GE products and came back sold on the idea of outsourcing their service sector and their engineering to India. And that began the stampede, and Welch is taking credit for it.
Right. And do you think that NBC, therefore, is going to focus on the disastrous impact that our trade policies permanent normal trade relations with China, NAFTA, and so forth have had on the loss of millions of good-paying jobs in America? I don't think so. General Electric is, has been historically anti-union. You think they're going to have programming on General Electric that deals with workers' rights? In other words, when we watch television, we know not to expect programming which deals with certain issues. Most listeners have probably never seen a program on television which portrayed trade unions in a very positive light, indicating what role they have played in improving the standard of living of American workers. You're just not going to see that on television. The issue that gets no discussion, virtually no discussion, in the United States today, we have the most unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. Richest 1% own more wealth than the bottom 90%. Wealthiest 17,000 families earn more income than the bottom 20 million families, and that gap is growing wider. How often do we see programming on that on television? It's virtually taboo. It's censored. You're not allowed to talk about that.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to talk about the fact that the United States is in many ways moving toward an oligarchy with a few large families with tremendous wealth while most people struggle hard just to keep their heads above water. Not allowed to be talked about. And, what really disturbs me is when we look at the lack of consciousness, political consciousness of the American people, the high number of people who don't vote, all of that is related to a media that does not deal with the reality of people's lives and provide ideas about how we can improve society. How do we ask young people to get involved, to be idealistic, if they don't have a clue about what's going on?
Absolutely.
I think that's a huge issue that we have to address.
And at the same time you see on CNN, at the same time that CNN should be reporting, in my opinion, issues about global warming and oil spills and Anwar and all this, all of a sudden we've got ads for oil drilling companies, as if I'm going to buy an oil drill, right? Why are they advertising that? Or when the defense contractors are in a mess and there's a scandal in the Defense Department, suddenly you see defense contractors advertising on CNN. And I'm just wondering how much influence those millions of dollars.
Oh, let me tell you something. In Washington, there are a number of quote unquote, inside the Beltway magazines, which are full of ads from the defense industry and the nuclear power industry.
Yeah, and it's not like they're trying to sell you a nuclear power plant. It's they're trying to buy influence, in my opinion.
Yeah.
20 minutes past the hour, we're here with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, the lines are lit up. We'll get to the phones right after this. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Brunch with Bernie. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, where democracy will not be downsized. Tom Hartman Radio Program with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. And Bernie, let's go right to the phones. We've got a bunch of callers here, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Glenn in Salem, Oregon on the line. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
How you doing, Glenn?
Hello? Glenn, don't listen to your radio. Listen to the telephone.
I'm not listening to my radio.
Okay, great. So, what's up?
Bernie, I see that you have a bill in front of Congress with Peter DeFazio about the WTO.
Yep. Peter and I work together on many issues.
Yeah. What can we the people do to help get that passed?
Okay, that particular bill, Peter and I have worked for many years on trade issues, and Peter shares my concern about our disastrous trade policies, which are enabling American companies to throw American workers out on the street, move to China, lower wages, and so forth. One particular bill that we're working on is to end permanent normal trade relations with China. Our trade deficit with China is now $160 billion. China is getting all kinds of high technology stuff, which is going to make them the information technology leader of the world in 15 years rather than the United States. What we can do is work with our friends throughout Oregon, throughout the entire United States, and get members of Congress to support legislation that would repeal permanent normal trade relations with China. We also have legislation regarding the WTO and says, hey, look, let's raise, start debating the issue of America's participation in the WTO. Has free trade, unfettered free trade, work well for the middle class of America? We think not. We want people to vote for our bill in that area as well.
Yeah, and people can contact their member of Congress by calling 1-202. This is the main switchboard, 1-202-224-3121, or toll-free 877-762-8762. And we won't go through the acronym this time. But, Bernie, can you very quickly explain what permanent normal trade relations means?
Sure. All that is free trade agreement with China, which was established a few years ago. For many years, we had most favored nation status with China, which had to be renewed every single year. Now it's been made permanent. And we don't have to review it every year.
And what that does
is repeal it.
And what it does is it drops the tariffs. It used to be that we would say, okay, if you're gonna make a pair of shoes in the United States and there's a dollar's worth of labor in that pair of shoes.
We don't make shoes in the United States.
Try
something else.
Well, being rhetorical. And there's a dollar's worth of labor in that pair of shoes, and you can make shoes in China for 10 cents worth of labor, then we're going to add a 90 cent tax on those shoes when you bring them into the United States to equalize the labor costs. That's how it used to be.
What a tariff basically says, a tariff is designed to protect industry in a country.
Right.
And what has happened right now is, as a result of big money interests, the GEs, the big corporations, they understand. They rather hire people in China for 50 cents an hour than American workers. That's what they wanted. That's what that's what's happening. And some of us are fighting back.
Right. And it's because of this permanent normal trade relations.
You have to repeal it in order to renegotiate.
And what that status does is it knocks down those tariffs.
Or it prevents
Congress from even passing tariffs, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the line. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
About the minute. There's some to qualify for Medicaid. You have to get rid of your assets, so you save your 401k. You do what they say you should do to
get poor.
Right. Yeah. You have to, and over 30 states require that you eliminate or use your 401k and wipe it out in order to get health care. And the problem is we need universal health care.
Hey, Glenn, you put your finger right on the issue. And again, when Tom and I were talking at the beginning of the program, talking about issues that the media does not talk about, certainly universal health care is one of them. The idea that somebody works their entire life, they save a few thousand bucks, they want to leave some money for their kids, they're going into a nursing home, they have to get rid of all of that before they can get Medicaid is an abomination. The bottom line here is we need to move to a universal health care system. Our health care system today is disintegrating. It is by far the most expensive and wasteful system in the world. And you're absolutely right.
It's time for a change. 1-866-889-8894, number 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, one of the major mental health care providers for conservatives in America. Oh, no, I don't want to pick on them. You don't like that, do you, Bernie, when you prefer not to call names? So I'll be gentle here. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us 27 minutes before the hour, number 1-866-889-8894. And, Bernie, we have Buddha in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Buddha.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Congressman Sanders.
Good morning.
Tom, I wanted to say it's the high point of my day when I hear your intro music, and it's the low point of my day when Sirius cuts you off after an hour.
Well, they play the other 2 hours later on in the day, so it's but in any case, let's stick to topics here.
I understand,
politics.
Congressman Sanders. I find you to be well spoken and intelligent, and I want you to know that when I hear you, I don't feel like I'm being lied to. You're
Thank
talking
you.
To media conglomerates, which we can tie back to the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And I understand this ownership issue was an amendment to that bill. And so my question is, even with the return to the Democratic control of the House and Senate, will it be possible to backtrack, repeal that particular amendment to the bill? I mean, is that realistic? Or are the Democrats so hooked into big money that it'll never happen?
Buddha, that is a very, very good question, and it's a fair question. As in many, let us remember that that bill was passed when Clinton was president. So it's not fair to just to blame, you know, the Republicans.
With his enthusiastic support, by the way.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, Bill Clinton was all for
it. I am an independent, and the reason that I am an independent is too many Democrats are tied into big money interest, including big media. On the other hand, there's no question that in recent years, though, I think a lot of Democrats have begun to understand the danger to our democracy of having a few large corporations controlling what we see, hear, and read. In fairness, there are some Republicans who understand it well. So, no, Buddha, I can't guarantee you that we will be repealing the onerous sections of that bill, but we'll have a lot better shot, I think, if the Democrats gain control of the House.
Thanks for the call, Buddha. Bernie, along those lines, I have a follow-up question for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Howard Dean, during the Democratic presidential primaries, he was riding high. He was on the cover of Newsweek and Time, and everybody was saying, this guy's got it. He's going to be the next president, you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah. And Chris Matthews had him on his show, his Hardball show. And he and I had seen nothing but largely positive coverage of Howard Dean up until that day. And he turns to Howard Dean and he says, what would you do about the big media combines, the big media giants? And Dean says, I'd break them up. And Chris looked genuinely shocked. And he said, you mean like GE, which owns the network that we're on right now, MSNBC? And Howard Dean said, yes, they should be broken up. This should be, you know, MSNBC should be separate. CBS should be separate. They shouldn't be part of big combines that do lots of other things. Media companies should be separate. We need to go back to enforcing those laws. And I turned to Louise, who's sitting next to me, my wife, and the producer of this program, and I said, that's it for Howard Dean. We're not going to see any more positive coverage of him. And sure enough, that was it was like a switch had been turned. That was the last day that I saw any positive coverage of Howard Dean by any of the major national media. All of a sudden, he was a crackpot in all of the stories that they were playing. Do you think that was that just a coincidence? Am I being paranoid?
I can't comment. I can't. You know, I didn't follow it that closely in terms of Dean and the media. But what I can tell you, I mean, and what common sense suggests, if you're a politician and your survival depends upon, you know, radio, television, newspapers, if you stand up to the media special interest, you know, you're running into trouble.
They'll eat your lunch.
Hot water. No question about that.
Yeah, they'll eat your lunch. Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free number. Jeff in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. I thought you should be aware that Frank Luntz last week with Al Franken handed you guys the news for the whole Republican Party. He said to Franken that government cannot create jobs. And I don't know why you that hasn't been something for you all to just go crazy with and say, you guys have just admitted that you're completely useless. And I would like to suggest, obviously there's dozens of examples, but I like to suggest you guys say, we're going to make it so that the government will hire electricians to go out and make sure that every light switch in every building has a light sensor and a motion sensor. And there you go. Think of all the jobs you could create like that. Why would that be a problem?
Well, Jeff, I think your point about how we can create jobs by improving our infrastructure and by making our country energy efficient is absolutely right. It's an issue that I've been working very hard on. And clearly, I mean, as a nation, the amount of energy that we waste, the fact that we have not moved rapidly into sustainable energy, whether it's wind or solar or other forms of sustainable energy, is a complete outrage. And in the process, not only do we protect the environment, but we create good-paying jobs. One of the reasons that I sponsored a bill to build substantial amounts of affordable housing units is not just because we have an affordable housing crisis, but it would put people to work at good-paying jobs. So in my view, there is enormous amount of work to being done cleaning up our country, improving our infrastructure. And not only is that a good into itself, but it creates a whole lot of good-paying jobs.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff, for that call. In fact, that was one of the major ways that FDR brought us out of the Great Depression. I mean, historically, economists and politicians and the average person in America has understood that if you put money into the hands of working people, people who are going to spend it, they're going to spend it. It's going to create more demand. Then there's people, small business people, are going to come in and say, "Hey, I can make this, you know, whatever it is that people want. I can make more of those." And things grow. They grow from the bottom up. I mean, we've always understood this, and all of a sudden, Reagan comes along with this bizarre, what Bush Sr. called voodoo economics. Supply-side economics. Let's give the money to the rich, and they will create jobs. And as if a job is like a gift that's being given to somebody.
Right.
When you hire somebody, you're hiring them because you expect to make more money off them than they cost you. I mean, it's very simple, right?
Absolutely.
So, and we need to reframe how we even look at labor in the United States. It's just this is just crazy. Matt in Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Bernie, I had a quick question. I'm working on my latest rant, and I would like to know the value of the U.S. treasuries that are held at this point in time by China, and it's something that I don't seem to be able to put my finger on.
Matt, I tell you, I don't have that information in front of me now. It is available. What we do know is that both China and Japan have purchased a whole lot of the U.S. debt. And I think increasingly people are concerned about that and the kind of leverage that might hold over public policy if they threaten to sell it. So it is a huge issue. It has to do with our deficit, our national debt, and our growing dependence on China.
I couldn't agree with you more, Bernie. I just didn't want to put it in print and send it to the paper until I have a good picture.
Right, it's out there someplace. Keep looking for it. You'll find it.
Yeah. All right, I sure will. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. And if we track that down, I'll let you know. A couple of emails we've got here, Bernie. Rodney in Grand Rapids, Michigan, he says, I just wanted to tell you that unemployment is up in the Grand Rapids area. As a result of the high unemployment numbers, we have had 17 bank robberies in the Grand Rapids area since January 1st of 2005. That's in 3 months. Is there a correlation between unemployment, the wiping out of the middle class, as we've seen ever since Reaganomics began to reign in the United States, between unemployment and crime?
Oh, I think the evidence is pretty clear that there is. If people have no hope, if people are not earning a paycheck, if they're not part of the system, I think their attitude is to hell with it. You know, I'm going to take what I can any way I can do it. What's the worst that's going to happen to me? It won't be worse than it is right now, sitting home with nothing. So I think there is a correlation between high unemployment, poverty, and crime. I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah, and then there may be a certain element of desperation. I mean, let's keep in mind an awful lot of the people that came to the United States in the 1840s were from the potato famine in Ireland, where many of them had been arrested for stealing food, and the food that they were stealing was the food that they were growing. Ireland was exporting wheat to England all through the potato famine, and they had more than enough food to feed all the Irish. It's just it was illegal for the Irish to eat it because the land was owned by the British. And so if they ate some of the wheat that they grew for the British, they would get arrested and put on a boat and deported to the United States as the penal colony. And people don't know their history. It's amazing. Anyhow, let's go back to the phone. Patrick in New Orleans, Louisiana on the line. Hey, Patrick.
How are you, Congressman Sanders?
I'm great, Patrick.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm awfully concerned about the environmental problems we're facing, and I don't see anyone seriously address, even yourself, I don't see anyone seriously addressing these problems. The Union of Concerned Scientists has pretty well proven it to me, UCSUSA.org, that we are indeed at a very critical juncture environmentally. And if we don't start doing something about it, we're fast approaching a point of no return. Do you have any comments on that, please?
Well, I agree with you, Patrick, and it's not just the Union of Concerned Scientists. There are, authorities all over the world who are worried about damage to our environment, which is now irreversible. We are working on it. I mean, sometimes for members of Congress, people may not hear everything that they do, but the issue of, for example, breaking our dependence on fossil fuels, stopping the terrible kinds of pollution that exists. We in New England are suffering from a lot of pollution that comes from Midwest coal-burning plants that are filthy plants.
Well, we're all suffering from the pollution from China, sir.
That's right, and that's absolutely right, sir. So, it is an issue we are working on, but what you have to appreciate, Patrick, we're dealing with an administration right now in Washington that has turned its back almost 100% on the environment. They don't even officially acknowledge that global warming is a problem. It's a problem.
Yeah, I know. Listen, I'm from Louisiana, and my senator, the Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu, refuses to acknowledge any problem, even in Louisiana, when in fact our delta is sinking. I mean, we're losing our delta. Nothing is being done about this. And I get more response from the Republicans, from Senator Vitter, for example, although he gives me pretty much the same administration line, that they're doing something about it and they're not working on it, blah, blah, blah. And Mary Landrieu doesn't respond at all. I mean, it seems like, in spite of the nice words, nobody's that interested.
Right, but what I'm trying to tell you, Patrick, some of us are. But we can't, you know, it's not quite as easy as you may think it is. I've introduced a significant piece of legislation that would radically change our entire energy policy. Do you think that's going to get to the floor of the House with Tom DeLay running it? It's not.
No.
I mean, the reason that we are ignoring in Congress environmental issues is polluters have a great deal of influence over government policy, and it's very hard for those of us who are in opposition to polluters and the corporations that pollute to get our bills heard or dealt with. So some of us are trying, I would say.
Thank you, Patrick, for that call. Shouldn't then, Bernie, isn't the problem behind the problem the fact that we have a situation now, in part as a result of Buckley versus Viejo and First National Bank versus Boston versus Bilotti, these two Supreme Court decisions that have allowed, you know, the back in the 70s, kicked open the doors to corporate money in Washington, D.C. And
the bottom line is, you know, and people, what ends up happening, and Patrick is concerned about the environment, somebody else is concerned about trade, and somebody else is concerned about workers' rights, whatever it may be. And very often, when you think about all of these issues, what it comes down to is that the people who are in power are dependent and working with large multinational corporations who do the polluting, who could care less about workers' rights, and they're the ones who are in power. And what we're looking at is not just an environmental crisis, which we certainly are, but a political crisis in that the government is not addressing the real concerns, in this case the environment, of the American people.
So is this, I mean, in Maine and in Arizona there have been really significant reforms.
And those are very important. And I would urge people, if Washington is not going to do campaign finance reform, which it won't, then what we have to do is state by state by state. And you're right. Maine has done a good job. Members now in the legislature do not have to hustle money. They can devote their campaigns, because it's publicly funded, to actually talking issues to their candidate, to their constituents. Arizona has done a good job. Vermont, to some degree, has done a good job. And people around the country should be demanding campaign finance reform state by state, so that big money does not control the political process in their states.
Yeah, and it has to begin in our own backyards.
Yeah,
Dennis, right. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky on the line. Hey, Dennis.
Hello, gentlemen. Hey,
hi.
You know, I'm one of the few 11%, I guess, 11%ers of African-American population that voted for Republican, and I kind of feel like the guy that opened the door up or the gate up for the Trojan horse now. But my problem is that you guys, you know, all these problems that we're mentioning, you just now touched upon it. You know, what are you going to do to take the House back and to save America? You need to get some sort of, not a contract with America, maybe start something like Save America and point out some of these things, and you need to have a concerted effort. I don't see it happening. I don't think, you know, from what I see, you guys are still backpedaling and ducking punches from the Republicans, and you're not controlling the whole thing.
I think, Dennis, let me just tell you, you know, I'm not a Democrat. I'm an independent. But I think your point is a good point. I think many people do not see that the Democrats are a real alternative. People say, well, the Republican Party is run by the rich and large corporations. That's true. And they go to the Democrats and they say, are you really the party of working people? And then they find out, well, no, not really. Some are. You got some Democrats who are fighting day and night for working people. You have some who are not. And that's one of the problems.
Well, my suggestion is that, you know, you need to get a game plan together, even though you're an independent, and I realize
right.
that. You know, you got to get a game plan together and decide, you know, what is going to be the format, how we're going to get.
I can tell you, Dennis, right now, Howard Dean, as head of the DNC, is working on that. They are seriously and aggressively, and we've had some correspondence. with Candy Stroud from the DNC just this morning. In fact, they're hustling on this.
Their problem is that they have people on. You know, you have 18 senators voted for this disastrous bankruptcy bill and so forth and so on.
Yeah. They have defectors within their ranks, as it were.
Right.
I mean the DLC is still alive and well.
Dennis has a good point that I think the Democrats would be effective if they laid out an agenda which the working class and middle class of this country says, yeah, that makes sense. Whether they can do that or not remains to be seen.
Yeah, and they need to not just lay it out, because they did very, very effectively, actually, in the platform in the last election. But they never marketed it. You know, Newt marketed his with his contract on America. I mean, they need to, Dennis is so right, they need to package it. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders 10 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, we'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Got to go back. We've got to go back.
Got to go and welcome back. Stovepiping the truth directly to the voters. Tom Hartman here with you with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the last day of the week. Congressman Sanders, let's go to Parvin in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Parvin, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, the volume's not real high. Wasn't sure you were talking to me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I could rag on the Republicans, but I think I'd be talking to the choir. Howard Dean and his raising money on the internet. Am I the only one that gives that gives me hope for the grassroots taking up a little slack again? Because maybe he can work around the corporations.
Well, I think that's a good point, and I think what Dean certainly initiated and did very well on is saying that a lot of money, that there are a lot of concerned people out there who you can reach through the internet, and he did very, very well. And I think the antidote to being dependent upon big money is, in fact, to get a whole lot of small contributions, and the internet can play a very important role in doing that.
Yeah,
that gave me hope.
Yep, and I think you're right. There are a lot of millions of people out there who can contribute $30 or $50, and we've got to reach those people.
Yeah, Parvin, thanks for the call. Bernie, just to wrap this up, I've got an email here from Ed. He doesn't say where he is. He says, I'm a World War II veteran. This sure isn't the country I left in 1943, to go off to war. He said, it scares me at times and just about brings tears to my eyes because it was so beautiful before. Just keep plugging and we'll keep listening and praying that the people in this country will soon wake up from the stupor this group has put them in. What do you think is the most effective thing that a few people, a family, a couple of friends getting together, whatever, that they can do to produce political change in America right now, the people listening to our program?
I think we've got to change our political culture, and that means reach out. Families can start doing things like holding political meetings, inviting friends together. Get 50 people to write send an email to your member of Congress and say, look, I want you to come to this church, to this meeting place, so we can talk about important issues. So the most important thing I think that families can do is reach out to other people and start the political discussions that we need that really are not taking place in an appropriate way around our country.
Yeah, and be contacting their members of Congress.
Absolutely. They work for you. You don't work for them.
Yeah.
And you should invite them to talk to you, and if you don't like what they're saying, hey, there are elections that take place every 2 years.
There you go. Very, very well said. And the phone number for Congress, of course, is area code 202-224-3121 or toll-free 877-782-8762. And just ask for your particular member of Congress. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us again today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
We will see you again next week. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where blue states see red and where red staters get the blues. Or we all become purple. We'll see what happens.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. You're in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy, my friends. Take no imitations. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in broadcasting. And occasionally an interesting story here. This from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Border patrol jobs outsourced to Mexico. And what some critics of illegal immigration are calling a setback for Homeland Security, 500 Border Control agents hired just this week learned today their jobs are being outsourced to Mexico. Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff said, "In a perfect world, it would be great to have American Border Control agents on the U.S. side of the border. Having said that, we are going to save a bundle of money by having those same functions performed by Mexicans on the Mexican side of the border." Recognizing that the outsourcing decision will not endear him to critics of the administration's immigration policies, Mr. Chertoff said, "I fully expect Lou Dobbs to rip me a new one." Hoping to silence criticism of the controversial plan, President Bush addressed the immigration problem head-on today in a speech in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He said, and I quote, "To those who would illegally enter our country seeking jobs, let me say this, stay where you are, and eventually our jobs will come to you." End of quote. That from the Borowitz Report. Yes, it's April 1st. More serious note, and by the way, welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The chat room you can drop in. It's quite full today. A lot of folks visiting. Just go to tomhartman.com, click live chat, and it'll take you right into the first it takes you to the message board. You click live chat again, and it'll take you to the chat room. And so welcome, or you will find some of the most erudite, insightful, thoughtful, intelligent, articulate, and sometimes downright weird. Minds in the entire world, the entire internet world, anyway. The Bush administration is jeopardizing our security, suggests Judd over on the thinkprogress.org blog, by excluding violent right-wing groups from the terror threat list. Now, get this. The Bush administration put together a terror threat list. Now, first of all, I have a problem with this whole thing of saying, okay, there's a separate category that we're calling terror. You either have a war, a nation declares war against you, Japan, Germany, right? You remember war. Or, you know, in Vietnam, we claimed that they attacked our ship in the Gulf, Gulf of Tonkin, during the McKinley administration. The administration that Karl Rove has said he's wanted to model a Bush administration on, McKinley claimed that the USS Maine had been fired on in the harbor in Havana. In fact, it had had a boiler explosion. But nonetheless, with his false claim of we're under attack, President McKinley took the United States into the Spanish-American War, seized Cuba, seized the Philippines, and on it went. So, in any case, you either have, in my mind, you either have criminals, which is how the Europeans have been dealing with terrorists for a long, long time, very successfully, thank you very much. The Greeks with the November 17 terrorist group, the Germans with the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Italians the Italians with their group, and on it goes. ETA, the Basque separatist group in Spain, the IRA in Ireland. And throughout this whole thing, their basic position has been, hey, if you're committing a crime, we're going to arrest you and put you in jail, and you're a common criminal. It is the same thing that Bill Clinton faced when Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building, the Murrow Federal Building, in Oklahoma City. What, are we going to declare war on all the right-wingers in America who don't like the government? I mean, keep in mind, Tim McVeigh had read The Turner Diaries, which is this novel in which a white supremacist guy blows up a federal building in Oklahoma City, And as a result of that, all the good white people in America rise up against the against everybody else, against minorities, against Jews, whatnot, and against the government, and overthrow the government and turn America back into a pure white Christian nation that is ruled by the Bible. I mean, that is the message articulated in the Turner Diaries that Tim McVeigh read after he came back from the Gulf War in 1991, and he had been trained to kill there, and he came back and he read this book and he said, "Yep, this is it." And it was his template. And Bill Clinton could have said, "Okay, we have terrorists. We need to declare a war on terrorism. This guy blew up a federal building. We got to do something. There's other ones out there. There's thousands of them. They're all over the United States. We clamp down on, eliminate civil liberties. Let's do away with the Fourth Amendment. Start, you know, anybody can, we can wiretap." No, instead, he said, "This guy's a criminal. He's a common criminal. He has no decency. He has no morality. He's a criminal. He's a murderer. He's a mass murderer. We're going to catch him. We're going to prosecute him. We're going to punish him. We're going to separate him from society. We're going to make sure he can't harm anybody anymore." Whether you're in favor of capital punishment or not, the reality is that's what happened. We caught him, and that was it. And the country was spared a long national nightmare, and we didn't lose our liberties over it. George W. Bush, on the other hand, were attacked by 18 guys with box cutters, 19 guys with box cutters, mostly from Saudi Arabia, and he uses this as an excuse to attack Iraq, which had nothing to do with it. So now, after 200 and some odd years, 230 years of law and legal precedent in the United States, and around the world, really, we have completely turned these things around. And Ira, I've got to ask you, turn the speakers down out there. I'm getting an echo in here. We have completely turned these things around to the point where we're now saying that there are three categories. Right? There are foreign governments that are declaring war against us that we can go after. That is, you can have a declaration of war, number one. There are individuals who are criminals, and we can go after them. Or number three, we've got this new category called terrorists. Now, it's not in the Constitution. It's not part of our historic law. But Bush sort of created it out of nowhere. Terrorists. I mean, you know, people have been claiming that title for a long time. And one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Menachem Begin blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. And it paved the way for the creation of the State of Israel. And not just to pick on him. I mean, as it comes to mind immediately. In the United States, George Washington was accused of being a terrorist. Jefferson, the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence. The British were very upset that we would not, that our army would stand behind trees and shoot them at them. How dare they not come out in formation? They must be terrorists. These are not the right rules of war. So anyhow, Bush has come up with this list to justify his so-called war on terrorism. He has come up with this list of terrorists and terrorist organizations and because of the passage of the Patriot Act, is able to say, okay, these people, they don't have the protections under the Constitution that other Americans have. We don't have to honor their rights like we do other Americans. And so what have they put on the group? The Animal Liberation Front, the Earth Liberation Front. These people who let minks out of cages, or people who go out and protest the cutting down of trees, they are now on the anti-terrorist watch lists. And their individuals are being followed around and whatnot. But on the other hand, in the United States, we have another group that maybe we should be concerned about. Now, see, my opinion is all these folks should not be on, there shouldn't be some unique terror list, or you can have a unique terror list, but let's be clear that it doesn't mean that they have or don't have the same civil liberties the rest of us do. We can't allow our civil liberties to be eroded just by fear and hysteria, very simply. But if you go back and look, this Justin Rood wrote this for CQ. The conspirators behind the 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City, which killed 168 people and wounded more than 500, were inspired by radical right-wing movements. You have Eric Rudolph. Remember Eric Rudolph back in 1996? The bombing in the Olympic Park when the Olympics were in Atlanta. He set off this bomb, and that poor schleb got, you know, the FBI, oh, we've got the guy, and it turned out it wasn't him. It turned out it was a guy named Eric Rudolph. And he had also fired into a gay nightclub. And he had a long, you know, long rap sheet of participating in acts against abortion clinics, and was a member of a group called the Army of God, an anti-abortion group, devoted to terrorizing physicians who perform abortions, or for that matter, even groups that would give out information about abortions. Okay. So, you know, it took him a while to track this guy down. In North Carolina, in connection with Birmingham, Alabama, abortion clinic bombing where killed a police officer, seriously maimed a nurse, same guy. Another Army of God member, James Kopp, was convicted in 1998 of shooting a doctor who performed abortions. He goes on to note, this is Justin Rood, he goes on to note, individuals affiliated with such groups have also been involved in many smaller terrorist attacks, including mailing hundreds of bogus anthrax letters to abortion clinics and in plots to obtain and use conventional chemical and nuclear weapons against civilians. In the United States, these are Americans. In the United States, planning acts of terror. In 2003, for instance, a Texan man, prosecutors say was a white supremacist and anti-government radical. You will recall, those of you who have been listening to this program for a couple of years, this happened. I was on the air when this story finally came out, when it finally broke the story. And it did not get covered in the mainstream press at all. It was not covered. This guy down in Texas was found with, he had enough sodium cyanide bombs to kill hundreds of people. He had machine guns. He had 60 pipe bombs. He had remote control explosives disguised as briefcases. His name is William J. Krar, K-R-A-R. The guy was arrested. He was sentenced to 11 years in federal prison. But folks like him, it turns out, are not on the watch list. If you are white and Christian in the United States, you will not be on the terrorism watch list. Radical right-wing groups are not going to be considered. However, ecology groups are considered potential terrorists. And then you've got like this 14-year-old kid, Mark David O'Berry, White Lake Township, was put together a kill list. 14-year-old kid, he writes down the list of people that he would like to kill. He didn't have any guns. He had no access to guns. The police searched his house. There was no access, you know, nothing. But he made this list. And so they arrested him under the anti-terrorism statutes. The kid is facing 20 years in prison. Man, maybe he should. I mean, you know, maybe he really is a threat or not. I don't know. But the point is, should we, if a 14-year-old kid writing up a list raises to this level, on the one hand, doesn't, and, you know, the Army of God, an entire group raise to that level? Well, no, they're white Christians. What's wrong with this picture? 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Here on the Tom Hartman program, exposing the con in conservative. The White House wants to move the victims fund. I got to tell you about this. This is absolutely incredible what they're up to. Here we have, first of all, you got the White House saying, well, you got to be really afraid of terror. But it's the eco-terrorists you have to be afraid of, not the guys who actually have bombs. It's the people who might spray paint a Hummer. But look out for them. And then this little thing with the victim. Well, let's get to that in just a second. First, let's take a phone. Go to the phone lines here. 1-866 889-8894, our telephone number. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom.
Morning.
Had a great conversation the other day. I work from home. I'm a writer, and I have an office here, and I've lately had a few service people out. One of them was a pest control guy, really wonderful, retired from the Navy as a colonel. His wife is a disabled vet, lost a leg in Desert Storm, and is very active pursuing the VA hospital. But what we talked about was a little bit about politics and staying involved. And he said, and this was really telling, you know, I get all those pamphlets close to voting time and all these statements, and I really don't have time to read them. I don't know much about what's going on, and I pretty much just go with my feelings.
Yeah.
And he's a liberal. And we talked about the necessity. I said, you know, voting is the ante to get to the table. We all have to do that as a minimum. But, you know, and I said, every day I do an hour of political involvement. I write letters, I talk to my congressman, my city councilman, my local representatives, and I stay involved that way, and it makes a difference.
And it makes a huge difference. And this is the bottom line, is that living in this country, or in any country, being a citizen, there is a certain social obligation that comes along with that. And not only is there an obligation to participate, but there's also tremendous benefits to participating. You increase your own social capital. You build the not just the political power that you have, but also, you know, you widen your circle of friends, you get involved with other people. There's a psychological and sociological plus to this, as well as the political plus. I mean, it's very healthy.
Is we've had some victories here locally. I was participated in those, and that's always fun to win. But you also find out new and interesting things that just aren't coming out most often, like this thing that there's a new bill before Congress right now concerning the NRA.
Yeah.
And what they're trying to do is remove the gun store owner's responsibility about selling guns to criminals by completely stripping the tobacco, alcohol, and firearms of their bureaucratic authority to remove licenses from these gun store owners. And the NRA, quite frankly, is surprised. It's called the Craig Bill. Senator Larry Craig in Idaho is introducing this, and it removes responsibility from gun store owners for selling guns.
Now, why? What's the possible rationale for that?
There doesn't seem to be any rationale for him doing this other than to appease the NRA. They want to...
What's from the NRA's point of view? Well, the NRA is, you know, positions itself as a large membership organization, but in fact it's the lobbying arm of the gun manufacturing industry. So, you know, probability, what they're saying is, hey, you know, more people, I mean, people come from all over the world to the United States to buy guns at gun shows. I mean, terrorists or bad guys or whatever, they come all here. It's the gun paradise. So,
well, Richard Clark pointed this out a couple of years ago when he had a potential scenario with a terrorist attacking the Mall of America using Tech 9 submachine guns, street sweeper 12-gauge shotguns, dynamite, and other semi-automatic weapons that Al-Qaeda has specifically instructed its followers to do, to buy legal weapons, to take them out and practice with them wherever possible. And that is exactly what's going on. And according to this article in Salon Magazine, the NRA is equally as surprised about this as anyone else, because Craig's bill really goes far beyond anything the NRA wanted in its last attempt.
Really? And you think that Larry Craig is just doing this to suck up to them, or has he gone off his rails?
I don't know. It's also got something to do with the Florida Republican Cliff Stearns, that they're changing some of the language in with ATF, and I am not sure why they're removing. The thing that keeps on occurring to me, Tom, with all this, especially with George Bush, and I think he knows he can't win Social Security,
right,
is that by going out there appealing to young people, he wants to break down the social contract. I think these guys are hell-bent on destroying our government.
Oh, yeah, and not destroying it, replacing it with an autocracy. I mean, they're going back to Alexander Hamilton's version of and John Adams' vision, rather, of American democracy, which is a country ruled by an elite few, and the rabble are under control. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the end of the week, our second hour, regular best of the rest of the news segment. And sometimes we get on folks who are in the press, as it were, members of the media, particularly the internet media. Sometimes we get on folks who can just drill a little deeper into the topics of the day, and that's what I wanted to do today. We have with us Josh Middledorf, who's an adjunct professor in the statistics department at Temple University, and a co-author or a co-participant in a fascinating project that has to do with figuring out what happened in the 2004 election. Josh, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, good to have you here. And we also have David Cobb, who ran for president of the United States on the Green Party ticket, and now is campaign director of Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County, California. There, his website, duhc.org. And welcome, David.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's always a pleasure to be on.
Oh, it's always great to have you here. Josh, first of all, is there a website that where people can go to find more information about this most recent work that you've done that we're going to talk about in just a moment?
Look at uscountvotes.org.
Okay, uscountvotes.org. Great. So I'd like to start with you, Josh. You and I have been corresponding for a while on this. I know you've been really working on this. And just give us a snapshot of what conclusions you have come to as a result of the information that the Matovsky Edison group, these are the folks who were doing the exit polls in the 2004 election, finally released. They still haven't released all their raw data, but they released a fair amount of data. And, you know, here you are, you're a professor in the statistics department at Temple University. You know how to look at data. What does it say to you?
Well, it doesn't take a statistician to look at this data. The results are really clear on the top, and it's easily explained to somebody in Statistics 1. The question is, you hear all these reports coming out of the election, all these horror stories, but we have no way of knowing what they add up to.
You mean whether or not there was widespread disenfranchisement? We hear the stories of people who they were setting up phony booths outside federal office buildings, even outside shopping malls, saying, register here to vote. People would register if they checked the yes, I'm a Democrat box. You know, let me vote in the Democratic primaries. Their registrations got thrown away. In the weeks before the election, particularly in Ohio, although this happened in many of the swing states around the country, phone banks were evidently in operation calling registered Democrats, telling them that their precincts had changed, so they'd go to a different precinct, wait in line for 6 or 8 hours, get all the way up to the front of the line and be told, hey, you can't vote here, you're at the wrong precinct. And then it was too late for them to start over. These kinds of things, is that what you're talking about? We don't know how many of these there were, what the aggregate impact was, or the possible hacking of the voting machines.
Actually, all the things that you listed were over and above what are measured in the exit polls. The exit polls are designed to measure to poll only people who actually made it to the polls and tried to vote and thought they were voting.
Oh, yeah, you're
so
right.
All these disenfranchisements and all these dirty tricks that come before the process or in the registration process were over and above the disparity in the exit polls.
So the exit polls, if the exit polls disagree significantly with the actual vote as recorded by these machines, like the one that Howard Dean hacked on Topic A with Tina Brown,
yes,
in 90 seconds live on network TV, hacked a Diebold central tabulator machine and changed the outcome of an election in an untraceable way, if the difference between the machines and the difference between the exit polls is significant, it doesn't reflect all those things I was just talking about. It would reflect what in your mind?
Just disparities in the way the vote is counted, corruption in the vote or mistakes in the machines.
What about incompetent exit polling?
That's another possibility, and there's where we have to look at the statistical pattern to see which of those two is more.
Okay, so you looked at the statistical pattern, and there were some areas where the exit polls actually agreed with what the voting machines said or the vote, you know, the counted vote, and then there were other areas where the exit polls were at substantial odds, substantially different, substantial variation from the quote actual vote. What made the difference between those two kinds of
curiously,
places?
The agreement happened in two subsets of the data. One, in overwhelmingly Democratic areas, where Democrats were completely in control. There was more than an 80% vote. The exit polls seemed to be spot on. They were completely in agreement.
They were accurate.
The vote count.
They agreed with the vote count. So if they said that the Republicans won. If they said the Democrat, and the percentage by which the win may have happened was reflected.
was well within 1%.
Right, okay. And this is in the areas where more than 80% Democratic control. The areas where...
The other area where the polls proved accurate was where the votes were counted by hand, paper ballots, the old-fashioned technique.
Small communities,
hard to corrupt.
Small states. Yeah, okay.
And in those areas, too, we found complete agreement between the exit polls and the official count.
So this would rule out the possibility that the exit polls themselves were being done incompetently. The shy Republican theory that was put forward, that Republicans were less likely to talk to young pollsters because for whatever reason, because they're irascible conservatives or something, because they were...
Well, Tom, I leave it to you to say rule out. I'm going to be more cautious and say it casts doubt on that. Hypothesis.
Okay, so this leads us to what possible conclusions?
Well, it looks like there was a widespread effort to corrupt the vote count. Widespread because you can see it in the pattern across most of the 50 states, and corrupt, I say, rather than error, because you can see in the distribution a shift. The distribution isn't wider than it's supposed to be, as it would be if there were errors, but it's actually shifted in the direction of the Republicans, indicating that there's been a bias in the vote count.
In other words, we, the people of the United States, this evidence indicates, we, the people of the United States, have been the victims of vote fraud, just like in the Ukraine, just like in Serbia, just like in Soviet Georgia, just like in Belarus. Is that what you're suggesting?
I suspect that based on the exit polls and the differences and the statistical patterns therein. But I would say we don't have a proof, and people who jump up and down and say you don't have a proof are absolutely right. You don't have a proof until you have an investigation and you find out exactly what happens. And our position is we'd like to see that investigation take place.
Yeah, okay, which leads me to David. And for both of you, actually, you know, I normally we take this as an opportunity to talk about the news of the week and what's up and what's happening and kind of wrapping things up. But, David, you were actually involved in the state of Ohio in trying to get an investigation into the possibility that the vote had been hacked or that there was vote fraud. What happened there?
Well, Tom, it was actually Ohio, New Mexico, Nevada. We actually attempted to force the investigations and recounts in many different places. And I think the professor makes an incredibly important point, and that is that this was widespread. The reality is that the corporate media has been attempting relentlessly to manufacture consent around a lie, the lie that this was a fair and clean election in 2004. The reality is it was a fundamentally flawed election, and I appreciate the professor's reticence, but you know what, Tom? I'm not going to be reticent. I'm going to assert that the evidence is clear and compelling that this was a flawed election. We have never had the investigation that we should have had. We, the people of the United States, must have confidence in the integrity of our voting system. It does not exist now. It should not exist. And frankly, anybody who does have confidence in it now only has confidence that is misplaced, because scratching the very surface of our elections demonstrates that the partisan administration of our elections, and especially in the hands of the neoconservative Republicans, fundamentally perverts the entire election process.
David Cobb, you actually helped finance the attempted recount in Ohio. And my understanding was that the Ohio law required a particular type of recount done in a particular way, and that wasn't done in that way. What happened in Ohio?
It was just outrageous. The reality is that the law did require that there be a 3% random sample done, and that if there was any discrepancy, and the law was any discrepancy, meaning a different number, then that there would be a full hand recount. The reality is of the 88 counties, we believe that only 3 of the counties actually did a random sample to begin with. In other words, they pre-selected which precinct numbers that they were going to use. It's a bit, Tom, imagine that you go to a poker game, or the listeners, you go to a poker game, and somebody's there saying, oh, we're so glad you're here to wager your money, please sit down, and you sit down and see that the cards have already been dealt. Well, how much do you think you'd be willing to wager under those circumstances? That's exactly what we experienced in Ohio, which was not a random recount. So the process was flawed to begin with. And even beyond that, even with the stacked deck, most of the counties reported different results, and they still did not do an actual hand recount. And as the professor says, hand recounts are much less prone to manipulation. And that's why the Green Party Cobb campaign is still in Ohio. We're still in litigation. This is, you know, the great unreported story. We're still fighting to try to expose what we can about the fundamentally flawed nature of the Ohio election. And I got to tell you, Tom, it's not just in Ohio. It is across this country.
Now, David Cobb, didn't the Attorney General of Ohio, whose name escapes me at the moment, and Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State, throw lawsuits at a number of journalists who were reporting on this and at some of you who
they
were...
did. They sued our lawyers at the National Voting Institute. They sued journalists. And then they had the audacity to attempt to depose John Kerry directly in the lawsuit that we were bringing. And the incredible insult there is that Blackwell himself has claimed privilege and refused to submit himself to sworn deposition testimony so that we could try to do the kind of investigation that the professor has said the data so clearly calls for.
No.
This has just been an outrageous example of the perversion of our election process.
And interestingly, before the election, a reporter asked Ken Blackwell, because this was back when they were arguing about whether or not the 80-pound paper rule, you know, these ballots had to be on a particular type of paper or they wouldn't count the absentee ballots. A reporter essentially said to Ken Blackwell, who was also the co-chairman of the Bush for President in Ohio committee, but he's also the Secretary of State in charge of the vote, saying, you know, you could end up the next Catherine Harris. Do you really want that? And Blackwell is said to have, you know, this is the report was that he smiled and he said Catherine Harris ended up as a United States congresswoman. You know, she was rewarded. And now we find Ken Blackwell, I believe it was in the Washington Post today, Ken Blackwell is running for governor, and he apparently has the support of the fundamentalist wing of the Republican Party in Ohio, which is not inconsequential, not a small...
Perhaps vote. It doesn't matter who has the support of it. He's the one who counts the votes.
What Stalin said, Professor.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to simply tell the truth as we see it. And the truth as I see it is that we have a situation where the vote counting process, the vote casting process is absolutely in question. And, you know, Tom, you mentioned the Ukraine. Let's just make the comparison, shall we? The Ukraine had a complete new election on the basis of one thing and one thing only. That was exit polling that did not match the reported results. In 2004, in the United States of America, we had exit polling that did not match the reported results, and concrete evidence, a mountain of concrete evidence of vote fraud and vote suppression, especially targeting African Americans and young people on college campuses. We could have a whole program, Tom, on all of that, and I know that you and other journalists have been beating the drum on this. Corporate media, of course, not covering it, but those listening to this program, the Tom Hartman Show, knows that there are people out there willing to tell the truth, and we're grateful for that, Tom.
Yeah, well, thank you, David. I'm very pleased that you're still fighting that fight in Ohio. What do you think is going to come out of this?
Well, it's interesting. It's very clear that there is what I call a new generation voting rights movement taking place across this country. It comes out of the legacy of the civil rights struggle and the voting rights struggle for African Americans and other people of color as it relates especially to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But this new generation voting rights movement says not only must we have the right to cast a ballot, but that ballot must be counted and it must be done in a way that is meaningful. And that's why we're calling for voter-verified paper ballots. We're calling for random hand recounts. And we're calling for publicly funded elections to get corporate money completely out of the election process. We're calling for instant runoff voting as a way to eliminate the spoiler effect so that people can be excited to vote for candidates they like rather than feel like they have to vote against candidates that they hate. We're talking about a whole new electoral democracy movement that's taking place. Frankly, it should have taken place after the theft of the Florida election in 2000, but here we are now in 2005, and it's exciting. I could, if you like, we can talk about all the exciting things that are going on in teach-ins, local communities, statewide conferences.
Yeah, well, we're down to about a minute and a half here, David. Give us a website where people can learn more about this.
Absolutely. Probably the best place is at Global Exchange, globalexchange.org. There's a whole democracy program. We're working very closely with our colleagues, Medea Benjamin, and others over at Global Exchange. So you can check that out or link out to the Democracy Unlimited website at www.duhc.org.
Okay. And Josh Middledorf, the work that you're doing, you're continuing on this, analyzing the statistics of this and trying to spread the word that, hey, this election stinks. There's something really seriously wrong. And not to put words in your mouth, but how can people learn more about what you're doing? What's your website? How can people get involved?
I would say that what we need at this point is more media attention. We need the newspapers to take some responsibility, to do some investigative reports.
So write letters to the
editor?
And
to contact their local friends in the press. Everybody knows somebody who's at a local newspaper.
So contact the media and say, we want this story. And Josh, what's the website real quickly?
uscountvotes.org.
uscountvotes.org. David and Josh, thanks so much for being with us today.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, what's wrong with this picture? The exit polls showing John Kerry won nationwide by 3%, and the voting machines saying that he lost by 2.5%. And oddly, that's about the exact same margin of what happened in the Ukraine. But nobody showed up in the streets in the United States while they did in the Ukraine. Why? Because in the Ukraine, they were ready for it. They had actually organized in advance. They had created an organization. They'd come up with a slogan. It was called Time's Up, however you say that in Ukrainian. They had a logo, a ticking clock. And they had cut stencils so that kids could go out and spray paint them on the sidewalks and things. And they had organized exit polls with reputable international groups, and as soon as the election was done, within minutes of the closing of the polls, they knew from the exit polls what the results were, and they publicized them far and wide, even though the government controlled the media in the Ukraine. Nonetheless, they were able to get out there and say, here's what we learned, and the way that they did it was they printed pamphlets very, very quickly, printed these things off on computers, and they put it up on the internet. And they got people out into the streets, and so all of a sudden the government was in a position of defending their phony numbers rather than what we have here in the United States, where you have scientists coming along and saying, wait a minute, it looks to us like the government's numbers are phony because the exit polls are showing something entirely different. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, Dave in Humboldt County, California, on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Oh, Tom, thank you for having a couple of national treasures on there. It is my belief, and you know it, I've felt it for the longest time, we have overwhelming evidence that this was rigged. It's circumstantial, but it's overwhelming. Why, you had Glenn Curtis on there, why would the Republican leadership retain somebody to design a voting machine that would be riggable and leave no record? Why would they do that?
For our listeners' sake, Clint Curtis is the guy that who says, in a sworn affidavit, has said that Congressman Tom Feeney of Florida, hired him and his company, the company that he worked for, to design and write software that could be inserted into the voting machines used in Florida to steal an election. And that he did do so, and he did deliver it to Tom Feeney. And Tom Feeney is now in the United States Congress, and there has been no attempt to investigate this, no attempt to look at it. And this guy's out there saying, hey, he has proof of it. He actually put online the software that he wrote, and people could look at it.
Why have they been blocking every effort to get these things made verifiable?
Well, you know, you got some people in the media who think that this is a Roswell flying saucer story, but I think that there's a larger bunch who are just very concerned, and perhaps legitimately so, about people not trusting the electoral system in the United States. But what baffles me, David, more than anything else, there have been two bills before Congress, one in the House and one in the Senate, for 3 years now that would have cleaned up this problem, and the Republicans refused to allow them to come to a vote. the Rush Holtz bill and Senator Clinton's vote. They will not hold a vote on these things, just simply to produce a paper trail. What's wrong with this?
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. The Tom Hartman Program with you. Well, in the news, a lot of deaths in the news this week. You know, this is the very serious ones, and I suppose the death of anybody is a very serious occasion, but it was just announced that Frank Perdue, the man who made $1.2 billion, getting him into the Fortune or the Forbes 400 most richest individuals in America list for years and years, Frank Perdue, at the age of 84, just died. And Sean Morey has some thoughts on that. What might happen?
Farmer had raised chickens since he was 24, all working for the colonel for 30 years or more, killing all the chickens and sending them to fry. Now it's payback time for ghost chickens in the sky.
Uh-oh. What if God is a chicken? Anyhow, our eulogy for the day. I don't normally do eulogies, but I just couldn't pass that one up. I want to get back to this White House amazing, extraordinary, mind-boggling. The victim fund was set up back in 86, I think it was, maybe 84, and the whole idea of the victim fund was, for a long time, we had focused on perpetrators, on the criminals. So, you know, let's, you know, we're going to serve justice. We're going to put these people in jail. We're going to execute them. We're going to whatever we're going to do. And nobody was considering the needs of the victims. And crime doesn't just have criminals. It also has victims. There has to be a victim for there to be a crime, at least for some crimes. And so, and let's not get into that. And so Congress came up with this idea that they would create this fund that would be the result. They passed laws that made it possible for juries to, on the one hand, say of perpetrators, you will surrender your assets, you will, you know, pay certain fines, these kinds of things, and also to allow law enforcement to seize the assets of people involved in particular types of crimes, particularly drug trafficking, money laundering, things like that. And they put this money into a fund. And right now that fund, it's in the neighborhood of $1 billion. $1.27 billion is the estimated take for the 2007 year, or that 2006 year, rather, that we are now into the 2006 fiscal year. They're expecting it to be $1.27 billion. And this money is then distributed. It's collected, you know, at the federal level. And it's distributed to the states in block grants, in other words, in chunks. You say to Texas, okay, here's how many criminals this is how many victims of crime are in Texas. You get this percentage, and little Vermont, you have a smaller percentage, or smaller Oregon, or whatever, you get a smaller percentage. And then the states decide how to give it to the victims in ways that is most appropriate, because they're closest to the ground. They know who the victims are. They know who needs what. They know where it's going to be well used. And it's not used to create brand new bureaucracies or anything like that. It actually goes to the victims. Well, the Bush administration, looking at this thing and saying, hey, $1 billion? $1 billion? I mean, that's a fair amount of money. Just think what you could do with $1 billion. And so they came along and they said, you know, we would, you know, this victims fund, this is just a fine idea. But it goes a little too far. It actually gives the money to the victims. I mean, you know, giving money to the victims. Why don't we take that money and we can use it to pay for the things that government has to pay for, like tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. I mean, this is a good use, isn't it, for this victims fund? Let's use it to reduce the deficit that we are causing, this multi-billion dollar deficit that we are causing by giving tax cuts to billionaires. And so here we have this story in the New York Times today by Gary Fields. Prosecutors, or was this the Wall Street? This is the Wall Street Journal. Prosecutors and advocates for victims' rights are organizing against a bid by the Bush administration to shift more than $1 billion from a fund for victims of violent crime and apply it to cutting the budget deficit. Listen, I'm out of adjectives. Mind-boggling, sick, weird. What? $1.27 billion they're expecting will be in the Justice Department's Crime Victims Fund, the state grant program, this coming year. And they want to give it to the Treasury Department to treat as general revenue. This is a fund that was set up by Congress in 1994, funded by fines, forfeitures, and fees levied against federal criminal offenders, and the money allocated in block grants to the states where officials make awards to eligible local agencies and nonprofit groups. They basically distribute it back, undoing the damage of the crime. I mean, that's the theory, right? Some of it is used to fund domestic violence shelters, programs to help crime victims specifically and their families cover specific medical bills as the result of crime, counseling services to people who have been victims of crime, even funeral expenses for people who were killed by crime or criminals. And the Justice Department, Well, actually, they went to John Nowacki, who was the spokesman for the Justice Department, and they said, what do you have to say about this? And he says, and I quote, "All I can say is, it's an administration decision," end quote. Patrick Leahy is a little upset about this, the senior Democrat on the Judiciary Committee at the United States Senate. He won Senate approval of an amendment to the fiscal 2006 budget resolution that would reject the diversion. But now we've got Congressman Ted Poe of Texas trying to get on the act. It's just amazing. David Beatty, who's the executive director of Justice Solutions, a victims advocacy group in Washington, he says, "We're not asking for $1 of taxpayer money. We're just asking them to appropriate our money. In other words, not to steal our money." The Wall Street Journal also notes, Gary Fields in the Wall Street Journal also notes, prosecutors are also watching what happens. Brad Fenecchio, district attorney for California's Placer County, says victims and witness programs in his jurisdiction cost about $769,000 a year, with $553,600 coming from crime victims' AIDS grants. If money isn't available from Washington anymore, he says, he doesn't know how he can make up the difference because, quote, "we've pretty much gone to a bare-bones operation." $1 billion. What is that, 3 days in Iraq? More or less? I consider, in fact, you know, take this out to the larger picture. So far in Iraq, we have spent, and this is the very conservative number, this isn't the amount that's been appropriated, but we have spent $160,036,007,200. I'm looking at the clock. The war in Iraq cost clock. Yeah, go to TomHartmann.com, click on the radio show homepage, and there's the cost of the war. You click there, and it'll take you to the clock, and you can see what the cost is. And you can sort it by U.S., by per household, by per person. You can look at the entire U.S. You can look at particular states, what the consequences of this are. For example, this $160 billion that we've spent so far on the war in Iraq, just to keep these things in perspective, $160 billion is about a third of the tax cuts for the millionaires and billionaires this year that Bush has passed. Okay. We're talking a tax cut that over the, you know, if you want to use the same event horizons for Social Security that they're using for Social Security, is going to account for some $11 to $12 trillion over the next 75 years. And you wonder, you know, why can't the government run? I would love to have Clinton's economy, and I'd be willing to play Clinton's taxes. I mean, that's the So what's the consequence of this? Well, with that $160 billion that we've spent so far just in Iraq, we could have put 21,196,854 children through a year of Head Start. The Head Start program, one that we know decreases dropout rates, increases school performance, increases the lifetime learning capability of students, and decreases the number of kids who end up in juvenile facilities or as adults end up in jail. 21,196,859 children could have gone through a Head Start program. Who won't? Now, because we got to have a war in Iraq, you know. It's as Karl Rove said to George Bush back down in 2002 when he went down there before we started this war in Iraq, when he went down with his PowerPoint presentation, as documented in Bob Woodward's book, you got to be a war president to be reelected. There's never been a president in the history of the United States during time of war who didn't get reelected. And Afghanistan just doesn't qualify as a war anymore. We got to have another war. And I'm telling you, look out for 2006. And I'm predicting Syria, although, you know, who knows? It might be Lebanon. It might be someplace else. It could be Cuba. It'll be somebody relatively helpless. It won't be Iran. Everybody says he's going to go after Iran. No way. They have a very strong army. They've got an air force. They've got they may have nuclear weapons. And they have strategic alliances that they've signed now with China and a number of other countries. They're not going to go after Iran. They're going to yell and scream about them, jump up and down. They're not going to go after them. They're going to go after somebody that they know can't fight back. That's the way bullies do it. We could have fully insured, just with the cost of Iraq so far, George W. Bush's election camp re-election strategy, the war in Iraq, with the money that we've spent so far for George W. Bush to get himself elected in 2004, the war in Iraq, we could have insured, fully insured, health, dental, eyeglasses, the whole bit, we could have fully insured 95,830,000 children for a year. With just the money that we've spent so far in Iraq, with the amount of money that we've spent so far in Iraq, everybody's talking about our schools are failing. I used to do work in inner-city schools. I've done work in all kinds of schools. But I would do in-service trainings. This is back when I was writing books on attention deficit disorder. I still am president of the board of directors of the Hunter School, School for ADHD Kids in New Hampshire. HunterSchool.org is their website. It's a nonprofit corporation. I make not one penny from this, by the way. We need not get into other celebrities and their affiliate. I'm not going to go there. In any case, I make nothing off it. And you know, it's a great organization. We could have, and the problem that we have in this country, people are says teachers unions are. No, the problem is that in the inner cities, in the neighborhoods that need it the most, they're getting the least funding. That's the bottom line. There's not enough teachers. There's not a lot of these schools don't even have books. I've been in them. I'm telling you, they don't even have the textbooks they need. We could have, with that $160 billion we have spent so far in Iraq, we could have hired for 1 year 2,773,456 teachers, full-time teachers. 2,773,000 of them, just with the money we've spent so far in Iraq. Oh, but we can't afford more teachers for our schools. Well, they're going to have to start doing these tests. We'll get into that when we get back. 20 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We've seen it all before. We know what it's all about. He lied to get us into war. He'll lie to get us out.
Yes.
This one more time. Like no one's keeping score. Election fraud should be a crime. Don't let them do it anymore.
Well, good luck on that one. You've got the Republicans in Congress absolutely refusing to allow Rush Holt's bill that would require voting machines to produce a voter-verified paper ballot, or Hillary Clinton's bill that would do the same thing, refusing to allow these bills to even come out of committee. much less be voted on by the entire House or the entire Senate. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, 25 minutes past the hour, is the Tom Hartman radio program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. is with us. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, now, I mean, you can't have pesky paper trails.
Yeah, but just sterile things, yes. And not only that, think of all that paper.
Exactly. They're really being conservationists.
I mean, you'd have to chop down a few trees to do that.
Yeah, and they're concerned about the environment.
That's right. The Republicans, they're very concerned about it. Clear skies initiative. I mean, absolutely. So, anyhow, Victoria, it sounds like you're outdoors.
I am. I'm actually driving to the vet.
Oh, okay. All right.
Not for me. But,
that's good to know. This is a variation on old folks eating dog food, people who don't have insurance going to the vet for their... I got this twitch in my leg, doc. Anyhow, okay, so what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria?
Well, I just left the White House press briefing, and Scott McClellan was asked a few times and was at great pains to say that the president has not made any plans regarding attending the Pope's funeral if and when he dies.
And did Scotty tell you that the president hasn't decided who he's going to replace the Pope with?
I thought Wolfowitz was up for the job.
I'll bet you George thinks he has a vote in it.
He probably does.
He's probably sitting around, you know, with Karl Rove going, Karl, who do you think that we ought to nominate for this position? Anyhow.
Maybe he'll put up Jerry Falwell. I don't know, one of his, you know, friends.
Well, Jerry, I mean, you know, here Frank Perdue just kicked the dust. Jerry's in pretty bad shape, I guess. You know,
it's amazing. This is not a good week for people. This is just not a good week.
Well, we are the depths of Mercury retrograde right now. So what can go wrong will, and I guess for some folks it is. But fear not.
So anyway, he said it was not appropriate, and he wouldn't be drawn one way or the other as to whether he's going to attend any kind of funeral.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that was it? I mean, that's like the news for the day? Okay.
But it was fairly brief. And again, there was some talk about the report that came out yesterday from the WMD Commission. But really, Scott had nothing new to say on that. I mean, one question that was asked by Helen Thomas was whether the president regrets, or basically is ticked off, is what she was really getting at. Upset was the word she used, that he went to war under false pretenses with bad information.
Right.
And she asked the question three or four different ways, but to everyone's complete surprise, she didn't get a straight answer.
Have they figured out yet how to say that this was all Clinton's fault?
No.
I predict they will. I absolutely predict that's what's coming next, is they're going to say, it's all Bill Clinton's fault. Even though the Republicans controlled Congress and all the appropriations during most of that period of time.
The language that they tend to use is quite careful. Previous administrations, they refer to.
Yeah.
You know, the not just this administration, but the previous administration.
Well,
Dick Cheney was
Secretary of Defense in, was it the Reagan or Bush administration? One or the other.
I'm not sure.
I think it was the senior Bush administration. And when Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense, he was the one who was pushing to cut all these programs. And in fact, most of the cuts that happened during the Clinton years were cuts that were put in place by Dick Cheney. So maybe that's why they're being a little softer on it than they might otherwise be.
I think that may be why, because for a while we heard very strongly about the Intel cuts during the 90s, you know, and what a mistake it was to not have agents on the ground and to rely on electronic spying, and that was all put down to the Clinton administration.
Yeah, but it really preceded that. Okay, right. Well, Victoria, thank you for the report from Washington, D.C. I hope you have a fine time at the veterinarian today.
Thank you.
Hey, be careful. Don't let it get too close to you with a syringe or anything. have a great day. We'll talk to you next week.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you
too.
Bye now. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, 29 minutes past the hour. In the Tom Hartman program, the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 27 and a half minutes before the hour. You're right here with the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America and our international listeners. We have at least two continents represented in our chat room right now. You can drop by there, go to tomhartman.com, click live chat. It'll take you to our message board, click live chat again, and it'll drop you into the chat room. And hang out with some of the finest minds in the world. Or give us a call at 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to say hello. Goldman Sachs analyst Arjun Murthy said factors contributing to the run-up in oil prices. You know, the run-up in oil prices. You remember when George W. was elected, oil was $18 a barrel, and now it's $54. Well, he says that they include geopolitical turmoil in oil-producing countries. Might that be a euphemistic way of saying war in Iraq? Anyhow, the report said prices could go as high as $105 a barrel. $105 a barrel oil. This being predicted by an analyst for Goldman Sachs. And it actually makes sense to me. In fact, if you go back to 98, when Osama bin Laden was warning us that if we did not get the soldiers that we had put in Saudi Arabia in 91 during the Gulf War, at the Prince Bandar Air Force Base, or whatever they call that thing, where he was horrified that men were drinking alcohol and observing women drinking alcohol who were not covered, their arms were not covered, their heads were not covered, and they were even allowed to drive cars. This was blasphemy on the Holy Land. Saudi Arabia, the Holy Land, and unequivocally, it wasn't a fatwa. I don't want to call it a fatwa. It was a statement, a letter to the United States and the world. Osama bin Laden said, if you don't get those folks out of our country, and if you don't stop holding the price of oil artificially low and thus stealing the wealth of our nation, we will attack you. And bin Laden was saying the real value of oil, the real price of oil, should be $200 a barrel. And that Saudi Arabia was keeping it artificially low, and they were doing so because of pressure from Washington, D.C., that it was our fault. And that we had soldiers on Saudi soil, and that was just intolerable. And he not going to put up with it, ain't going to take it. And, of course, we got the soldiers out of Saudi Arabia 6 months ago. George W. Bush finally said, okay, I'll get the soldiers out. Don't hit me before the election, please. And now, Goldman Sachs analysts saying oil $105 a barrel. Really what it's all about, and I've said this so many times, it's getting blue in the face, but really what it's all about is not that the price of oil is going up. It's not that the price of gold is going up. It's not that the value of the euro is going up. It's that the value of the dollar is going down. Yes, of course, the price of oil is going to go up as a function of scarcity. That is happening. But the larger variable here is that the value of the dollar is going down. Why? 25 years of Reaganomics, and it's gotten particularly bad, particularly insane over the last 5 years. With George W. Bush borrowing trillions of dollars to give tax cuts to his wealthiest buddies, and you can't even really call it a tax cut because they're paying less in taxes, but the government's borrowing that money from you and me, they're borrowing it from China, but we're going to have to pay it back. They're borrowing it in the name of you and me, in the name of you and me and our children, and we're going to have to pay that back. So it's really just shifting the taxes from the Walton family down to us folks. And the result of this is the rest of the world looks on and they say, hey, that U.S. dollar ain't worth nothing. And we had our little stock market bubble. And I've been telling you for a year now, 2 years, that Alan Greenspan, partisan hack that he is, was cranking down interest rates into actual negative territory, where interest rates were below the inflation rate, in order to try and get the economy goosed up to the point where George W. Bush could get reelected in 2004, or elected, to be more accurate, for the first time. And that the result of that was going to be an explosion in the housing prices, and the result and the explosion in housing prices is a bubble. It's phony. I mean, here we are. We're moving from Vermont to Oregon. We're selling a house for almost three times what we paid for it 10 years ago. I mean, is that it reflects the cost of housing, but it's a bubble. And so here in the Wall Street Journal, Treasury Secretary John Snow called on Congress to limit holdings of mortgage loans by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, they used to be government-run corporations. Now they're heavily government-regulated privately owned corporations. Earlier yesterday, Freddie Mac reported a 41% decline in income. These corporations basically hold mortgages. You take a mortgage out with your bank, and if it's federally guaranteed, these are the agencies that do it. Mr. Greenspan recently told Congress he saw no need for Fannie and Freddie to hold more than $100 to $200 billion of mortgage apiece. In other words, he's saying, look out, guys, these mortgages are going to go south. Because when the value of homes starts dropping, a lot of people are not going to, they're just going to say, hey, why am I paying all this money on a house that's not worth what I'm paying for it? And they're going to walk away from them. The same thing happened in the 70s. The same thing happened in the 30s. And so Greenspan goes before Congress and he says, Fannie and Freddie, our corporate, our government bond, holders of mortgages, should not hold more than $1 to $200 apiece. What's the combined holdings? $1.5 trillion. Can you spell bubble? 1-866-889-8894. Let's take a few phone calls here and see how folks are thinking. Alice in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Well, what troubles me most, Tom, is that our very corrupt government still has those crooked machines. And now I understand that our governor may be trying to bring these machines back to California.
You're speaking of the voting machines, Alice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is my understanding that the Gropenator, Herr Gropenführer, has suggested a fellow to be the new Secretary of State who has ties to the voting machine industry or connections to the voting machine industry, and we'll bring them back. That's my understanding. You live in California, Alice. Are you hearing much about this in the local media there?
Oh, yes.
So the discussion of the voting machine specifically?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's very good news. That's very good news. Do you think he'll get away with it?
Well, I hope not.
Yeah. Yeah.
I tell you, I'm so disgusted with this government that...
Alice, who was the first president who you have a clear recollection of in the United States?
Well, I remember Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson, World War One.
Yeah. My dad was in World War One.
Uh-huh. You're 91 now, are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And still a registered nurse. And
yes.
Yes, and you remember Wilson, you remember Roosevelt, of course, you remember Truman and all these guys. Who would you say of all the presidents that you have observed in your lifetime, who would you say was the best and who would you say was the worst? Just curious.
Well, I guess we all of my generation probably thought Roosevelt was because he kept us going through the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And but in spite of what everybody is saying, I really like Clinton. And I like Hillary.
Uh-huh. You like Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And who do you think has been the worst president in all those years?
Pardon?
And who do you think has been the worst president in all those years? I mean, you had Woodrow Wilson. He got us into World War One. He suspended habeas corpus.
Bush is a...
George W.? Yeah. Okay. I had a feeling that was coming. Alice, always great to hear from you. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Have a good day.
You too.
Yeah,
thanks for listening to us there in KGOE in Humboldt County. Gene in Hillsboro, Oregon on the line. Hey, Gene, it's West Coast Day. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to let you know that there was already an article on Google News. It's gone now. But there was an article with a headline saying Bush officials blame Clinton.
You're kidding. For the intelligence failure.
Yeah.
They've already done it. I told you. I mean, there's no way that this administration is ever going to take responsibility for anything. They'll take credit for for good stuff. They'll never take responsibility for anything negative.
Yeah, I guess apparently it was a senator from Missouri area. Senator from Missouri that leveled the charges.
Yeah.
It's since been replaced by an article with the headline, Intelligence Committee continues to stonewall for Bush.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that it'll probably be the main talking point for the right wing talk shows today. You'll be hearing a lot of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's good to know that you're moving to Oregon.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. My daughter lives in Portland. She's lived there for 4 or 5 years. My mother-in-law moved out there about 4 months ago, along with my brother-in-law and his wife, and who had been living here in Vermont. And so Louise and I are following them out. And we're looking forward to it. Gene, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I want to get back to the news here, though. Just a few things that I think are really, really quite important. The European Union and Canada, this again from the Wall Street Journal today, the European Union and Canada plan to slap an extra 15% tariff on a range of U.S. industries' exports starting May 1st, hoping to force Congress to change a trade law that allows American companies that are hurt by products dumped in the U.S. market to receive cash payments. Now, on the surface, it sounds like this is just, you know, it's a trade debate, our argument. What this is all about is this is the consequence of what Ross Perot, that crazy old coot with the big ears, Ross Perot, what he was saying, and both Bush and Clinton were saying, oh, no, Ross, you're nothing to worry about. And he was saying, you sign that NAFTA agreement. You sign that WTO agreement, that GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, the GATT agreement, which will create the World Trade Organization. You do that, and you are handing over the sovereignty of this nation to multinational corporations. And the decisions will no longer be made in a democratic way, in a democratic society, by we the people here in the United States. They will be made by multinational corporations, answerable to nobody. Not even answerable to their stockholders. Most people think that corporations have to do what their stockholders say. Not true. In fact, there's a movement in the United States right now to change the laws so that boards of directors actually have to be answerable to the stockholders. But right now, corporations are really run, particularly large publicly held corporations, are really run more like kingdoms. Literally, like the old-fashioned kingdoms. And so, we the people of the United States passed a law that said if a country is dumping, that is, if they're selling products here in the United States below their cost of production, just to drive our farmers, our business people, our, you know, whatever the industry may be, out of business, just to drive us out of business, they're dumping into our markets, then we have the right to put up trade barriers, to charge tariffs, to exact penalties from them, or simply to refuse to allow those products into the United States. And the World Trade Organization, the corporate organ, has said, sorry, you can't do that. And has given authority to Europe to start slapping a tariff on our exports. As Scott Miller notes in today's Wall Street Journal, the EU took its step, quote, in light of the continuing failure of the United States to bring its legislation in conformity with international obligations. In other words, you folks in the legislature, you think you're supposed to be representing the folks back home in Vermont or in Oregon or in Ohio or in Michigan or Texas. You think you're supposed to be representing your constituents. Sorry, you answer to us. You're now dancing to the tune of the multinational corporations. And this is how we're going to have it. Oh, but it's causing us to lose our middle class. It's wiping out a tough. The profits of the multinational corporations are far more important than your middle class. You don't believe me? Just listen to right-wing talk radio. I mean, it's the subtext. They don't come out and say it. But it's there. There's no secrets here. Richard Mills, our trade representative, he said, we're disappointed that this step is being taken. The United States is working to comply with the WTO decision regarding the Byrd Amendment. Yeah, right. Some in Congress, notes Scott Miller, led by Senator Robert Byrd, for whom the amendment was named, this is the anti-dumping amendment, have steadfastly refused to change U.S. law, formerly known as the Continued Dumping and Subsidy Offset Act of 2000. The Bush administration? Are they coming down on the side of domestic manufacturers? Are they coming down on the side of local companies in the United States? Are they coming down on the side of American industry? Are they coming down on the side of the American worker? Are they coming down on the side of the American middle class? Are they coming down on the side of keeping business here at home? We only produce now 16% of what we consume. Wouldn't it be a good idea if there was an international disaster of some sort, whether it was a monetary disaster, an ecological disaster, a war, whatever, maybe even if there was no disaster at all, wouldn't it be a good idea if we simply produced what we use? We can't build missiles now without parts from China, and China is telling us that they may be willing to go to war with us over Taiwan or over oil in East Asia. And we can't build missiles without their parts. So what does the Bush administration have to say about this? Well, the Bush administration, I'm quoting from today's Wall Street Journal, the Bush administration has encouraged Congress to comply with the World Trade Organization. Hey, it's the Bush administration of, by, and for the multinationals. The people? Come on, give us a break, they're saying. I'm Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now you can say that I've grown bitter, but of this you may be sure. The rich have got their channels in the bedrooms of the poor, and there's a mighty judgment coming.
Yes, indeed, or I might be wrong.
But I may be wrong.
But I don't think so.
You see, I hear these funny voices in the Tower of Song.
Sing it, Leonard. I'm sorry. Some days the old DJ in me comes back out. I just can't stop it.
I don't know how the river got so wide. I loved you, baby, way back when.
There you go. It's one of these days I'll be, I don't know, I'll playing a little more music here. We encourage risk in the United States. We always wanted to encourage risk. It's what built this country. We wanted to encourage people to start their own businesses. We wanted to encourage them to step out and take a chance. And to know that if they took a chance and they failed, that they could start over. And if it wasn't for that knowledge that there was a floor under you, basically, if you failed, a lot of small businesses never would have started. A lot of inventors never would have, you know, given up their day jobs and gone off inventing. Thomas Edison might not have invented the light bulb. Who knows what wouldn't have happened? And now, speaking of the dollar, you know, about to go over the edge, here we have only weeks before Congress is likely to approve, this is from the Los Angeles Times, is likely to approve long-sought overhaul. Bankruptcy judges across the country, bankruptcy judges around the United States, are warning that this measure would undermine the very section of the law under which debtors are now repaying more than $3 billion annually to their creditors. They note that this has served as a safety net for two centuries. The advocates, says Keith Ludden, a federal bankruptcy judge in the Eastern District of Tennessee in Nashville and an authority on bankruptcy repayment plans. I would think so. He's a judge, a bankruptcy judge. He said the advocates, that's of this legislation that the dirty 18, these 18 senators just voted for, the advocates aren't trying to fix the bankruptcy law. They're trying to mess it up so much that nobody can use it. Could it be that the banks are pushing so hard for this because they see something coming on the horizon that the rest of us don't see and that they're trying to pre-position themselves? The whole thing with cars, for example. Under the current law, those who file under Chapter 13, you only have to repay the car loan up to the value of the car. So if you owe more on the car than it's worth, you don't have to pay the rest. This new bankruptcy law changes that. Now you have to pay the entire initial loan, even if it takes you forever. What they're doing, it just is one small example. What these guys are doing is trying to establish in the United States a permanent underclass, a permanent class of terrified workers. They are literally taking us back to the days of Scrooge and Marley Incorporated, where Bob Cratchit's son had no health care and might die because he had no health care, and they had to rely on the good graces of their employer, who could be a tyrant and could abuse his employee. And you know, you're going to put a lump of coal in that stove, Bob Cratchit? I don't think you're going to. No, we're not going to allow you to do that today. You're just going to have to be coal. And you showed up 5 minutes late. I'm going to dock a day's pay from you. And the employee had nothing to say about it. He had no right to speak up. He had no unionization rights. He had no labor. He had nothing. That's the world the cons want to take us back to. That wonderful world of Victorian England. That wonderful world of the McKinley administration. The time Karl Rove says he so admired the robber barons ruling everything, including the government. We're going to stop them. Here on the Radio Home of Democracy.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.